Hello, Tomorrow Built Today listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Jana Mesher-Smith. For those of you new to the podcast, we cover investing trends and predictions along with discussions about the latest news in tech. This week, we are bringing you several talks from Lightspeed's Enterprise Scale Summit that took place recently in San Francisco. You'll hear firsthand from industry icons in the enterprise with their tips for successfully scaling a company. One note to keep in mind is that because we recorded this live, which included a lot of hand gestures and animation from the speakers, the voice quality isn't perfect, but the content more than makes up for it. Please sit back, enjoy, and be ready to take notes. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation between Krista Quarles, former CEO of OpenTable, and me, Jana Mesher-Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. I'm actually really excited about our next guest. Krista Quarles was most recently the CEO of OpenTable, where she managed a large global team of more than 1,000 people across 20 countries for the beloved consumer brand. Prior to that, she was the chief business officer at Nextdoor and was also an SVP at Disney. Earlier in her career, she actually worked on Wall Street as an analyst, and she is currently a board member of Affirm, which is a Lightspeed portfolio company, as well as Kimberly-Clark. So please welcome Krista to the stage. Welcome. Thank you for joining us
Thanks,
today.
Thanks, Jana.
Would love to talk a little bit about your experience in building go-to-market teams. You've done this numerous times in your career across multiple companies, but maybe we start with OpenTable.
Yeah, I think, you know, at OpenTable, it's an example of, I think, the early strategy working because it was simple. And then at some point, that strategy hits a wall. And I think the old approach, the old way of thinking, ends up being, needs to be questioned. And in our case, I think, it, you know, I would argue that OpenTable was largely a sales-driven company and culture. And so the sales team just kept going at it and going at it and going at it. And what was happening around us was the world was changing, technology was changing, the product needed to change, the strategy needed to change. And so it was, you know, an element of, in that case anyway, taking what had been built, and then in order to get it to the scale that we needed it to be, in order to see, you know, to cruise through the invisible asymptotes, as it were, we had to redefine what it was that these people were doing every day. And I think the most important thing that I did when I first got there, I think I went out and met with 120 restaurateurs and built deep empathy for the restaurant. Unlike, you know, a company that's going after just, you know, to the extent that you can call it a logo company, right? Like, you can see all 1,000 people that you could potentially ever buy your software. I guess we're more like Atlassian in the sense that, you know, the thousands actually, you know, the number is in millions of restaurants. So SMBs are an interesting category of go-to-market specifically. But within that SMB spectrum, there were, you know, there were large-scale enterprise restaurants who very specifically needed, you know, product evolution. So they needed, you know, controls over who could see what. They needed different kinds of reporting. We didn't have an enterprise business at all. So deciding, okay, are we going to go after the enterprise? What product implications are going to happen when we go after the sales cycle of an enterprise-driven organization? And yet, you know, and then you've got a whole machine that exists over here that doesn't act, speak, or understand the enterprise. So going after that, it was almost a startup within OpenTable to go after the enterprise sector. But within the core of that restaurant group, if you think about restaurants, there's the base layer of restaurants are like, just get some butts in seats. So what we were effectively driving is marketing and marketing automation. But we didn't act or behave like a marketing partner. You were either on the grid or off the grid. So that was a very clear signal. We needed to evolve our product around that layer. The next layer up is like, okay, now I've got some people coming to the restaurant. Now I need operational help. I need our, you know, the software that sits inside the restaurant needs to put more butts in seats. And we called it internally Tetris. It's like, how many, you know, how do you fit those cubes in such a way, two top, pick them before top, you slide another one in. How do I expand essentially the throughput of the restaurant?
restaurant. And then ultimately at the top, which is, you know, I've now got a lot of people, I'm very successful at driving them in. How do I create magical, wonderful, beautiful experiences when you come in? So the hospitality layer. And so we didn't have definition for any of it. So we had to kind of like really map the TAM that we had very specifically. Who was it? Where were we going after it? And then where were the roadblocks? I mean, in a city here like San Francisco, 75% of the restaurants in our original TAM definition were already on the platform. So there didn't feel like there needed, you know, we had to rethink where we were going. And I think the product and frankly marketing implications of it were almost as important as we were scaling those go-to-market teams as the sales structure itself.
Yeah, I'm so curious. I mean, you joined in like 2014, 2015. And so what do you kind of do when you're about to run out of TAM and like you're still expected to deliver like crazy high growth? And I know you guys obviously expanded internationally, but maybe kind of talk about what that's like to join an already high growth company.
Well, it wasn't high growth. Mm-hmm. It was high penetration.
High penetration.
And I think the very specific reason I was brought in was because growth started to do this. Yep. And I think that's one of the challenges that you see in a lot of companies where the original product market fit served a very unique set of TAM. And when you hit that roadblock, a lot of companies go sideways. And you know, I think it's this question of how do you start figuring out what are the market adjacencies? What asset do we have that no one else has? And so we started looking and saying, okay, here we sit on the transaction layer of connecting inside a restaurant, which you know, at the time I joined was about 30,000 restaurants. But there's up here at the discovery layer, you know, TripAdvisor lists like 4.2 million restaurants. Google is going to have data and information on my search background. And here's a fun story. We were just actually chatting about going to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And I was there, and I stopped at this one spot, this latitude-longitude point, for 90 minutes. Didn't put anything into Google, but obviously they were tracking me behind the scenes. And, you know, 20 minutes after I departed, they asked me to review the restaurant that I was clearly at. But it was only because they had seen my motion stop at this lat long for that point in time. And so we're sitting there going, oh, crap. Like, you know, Google, nobody is going to have better data at the discovery layer than Google. But what we had that no other company had, and I think this is an important question to ask yourself, what data set that you do you have that is super unique that is going to then enable you to sell more effectively? And in our case, it was that node of connection. We knew which butt sat in which seat at which time. And that data turned out to be a really effective tool then for our sales teams to go in and, you know, go into our other markets. So, for example, we started just putting up listings of restaurants that we did not have a commercial relationship with in. But then we could start capturing the data that sat on that consumer demand flow that we were getting as part of our marketplace. So then we productized the ability to go in with the restaurant and say, hey, did you know, 2,000 people came into your restaurant last month. 500 of them booked somewhere else. Don't you want those people? How do you use the data, use the demand flows that are already existing within the construct of your product, and use that to drive a sales cycle? And so when I would talk to the sales team, I was like, it's not that you use data to make the sale. Like, data is the foundational layer of who and what we are. And I think reorienting their head around, it's not just like pushing and driving and, you know, moving on the sale. It was back to what Ravi was just saying, actually. It was demonstrating very clearly and very specifically the ROI. You spend the dollar here, here's what you're getting back. And it was a mathematical sale as opposed to a, you know, pushy, irritating salesperson sale.
We've all had those. Talk a little bit about international expansion.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this, again, kind of words to the wise, like, please, if you are starting a company, put at least, you know, I always say, put the outlet in the wall when the walls are down so that you can plug in international later. Because I went into a company where that was not the case. So we had to replatform our international technology, essentially. Like, if you did a search on a London restaurant in the U.S., you 404 when I show up. There was a different app in every market. It was a very hodgepodge way of kind of going international. And as a result, our international business was not super healthy. It was also, I think they took the approach of when they started the company in the US, they just tried to replicate that internationally? Well, the reality is the world had moved, and especially in Europe, but increasingly in Asia, there, you know, as soon as you fund something in the U.S., that exact replica is getting funded in Europe and in Asia. And so you develop a competitive set that you didn't have when you started the company here. And I think that's the thing that needs to be, you know, kind of brought up. So when I got to OpenTable, the company was approaching their international business like they did it here, and they were just late. They were behind the ball. They had competitors. They didn't have competitors here. So the entire way of thinking about how to sell changed. They also were a bit too diffuse. They tried to do too many, and you know, OpenTable is a strange business in the sense that it's a local network effect business. So you need density of supply and demand in a specific market in order to actually have a functioning product. But they went everywhere at once, and that meant they were successful nowhere at once. And so what we did was we kind of like, you know, skinny down the approach of the existing international markets. We upgraded the technology. But then we ultimately had to build a playbook for how are we going to go into new markets. And I think the important lesson there is to remind yourself also, you know, what got you to scale isn't what is going to be effective here. So I would always push the teams and say, what's the unscalable thing we need to do to get to scale? What are the crazy ideas? And so it's hard because I think people's orientation is either like operational, they turn the crank, grind, versus more entrepreneurial. And what I found was organizationally, we did not have a lot of entrepreneurial people. And we had to find them, bring them. And it's often, you know, when I think about sales specifically, you know, it's that lone wolf person who's going in a lot of these markets like, how do you sell in this market? What are you selling in this market? How do you redefine and reshape what that is? And I think that was, you know, we had to kind of infuse that as part of then the expansion for how do you now go into the Netherlands or Spain or Australia or, you know, Hong Kong, because it's not the same rule book that existed here.
How do you kind of wait? It's like, on one hand, you know, you just want to scale and grow as quickly as possible. But on the other hand, you need focus and you need, you know, the appropriate amount of resources to go and win new markets. And I saw this, I have been an operator my whole career and only recently moved into venture, but I worked at Netflix. Netflix didn't expand internationally for the first 13 years of their company. I worked at Twitter, and Twitter's like a big open platform. So we were international from day one. And, you know, the difference in terms of, like, focus and how we scaled in those companies was very, very different. So how do you kind of weigh those things?
I think it is hard. I mean, I think that is the job of, you know, the CEO. Because if everything's important, nothing's important. And to be really, really crystal clear, like, you can't do everything at once. And so we're going to pick, you know, in the case of our international expansion, we're like, we're going to go into two markets. And we're going to deploy two strategies. It was essentially an A-B test. Of our strategy, because you know, we had a hypothesis, but nobody. I mean, you know, the thing I learned from my gaming days, also of Lightspeed Company, Playdom, was that people were only right 30% of the time. We would like we'd do bets ahead of A/B tests, and you know, even the smartest, most thoughtful person was really only right a small percentage of the time. And so we had some hypotheses about how to go into markets, and not all markets are obviously the same. And I'm sure the Dutch don't like to be compared to the Spaniards, but we went in and you know just started to see and say, okay, like what is the right way? And I'm a little bit of a street fighter, so I'm gonna go in and figure out what's gonna work, but I don't always know ahead of time. And I think, you know, in a company, you only have finite resources. So it is about, okay, this is going to be key to our strategy. Here's what Horizon 3 looks like. You know, back to Henry, I'm not 100% sure of all the steps that are going to get us to Horizon 3, but we know it's important. So let's devote company resources to this and then iterate. I think another mistake a lot of companies make is like they, you know, especially companies that are not necessarily succeeding and they've hit those roadblocks, they're like, oh, we tried that, it didn't work. Well, why? You know, what was the postmortem? Why didn't it work? Is your hypothesis wrong? Was your, you know, data set wrong? Was your market like what, you know, the constant pushing and saying, well, why? What was it about that? Let's go get more signal. Is it just simply, and there are times where you're just wrong. You know, I mean, we did an experiment where I said, you know, kind of taking it from the macro to the micro, I was like, let's just own a street. Back to this idea of comprehensiveness. So if we had the discovery layer of Google and Yelp and TripAdvisor, I was like, let's just own like Fillmore Street or University Ave. So I said, let's go in and just give it away. Like, we'll bring diners to restaurants. And we couldn't actually give it away because these restaurants were like, well, we're not an open table restaurant. And so we had a brand problem. And then we realized that, like, there were all these other issues that sat underneath it. And so it was an incredible, you know, way to just sit there and go, oh, what have we not thought about this problem? What are the unknown unknowns? All right, let's go in and tweak this and iterate.
I'm curious also, how do you think about pricing models and evolution? Because I know you've made, you know, a decent number of changes while at OpenTable, but I do think that that happens for so many enterprise companies as you evolve and scale and really kind of figure out your value proposition.
Well, I think simplicity first is a good rule.
Yep.
And then at some point, it may not serve you anymore. And I think that's an indication of what kind of happened to us. You know, we were $249 a month and $1 per head for the button seat that we delivered, which is essentially a marketing fee. But if you go back and, you know, in those 120 restaurateurs that I met and many, many more since that initial meeting, you know, there's a spectrum of restaurant out there. Some of our restaurants, like, you know, if you look at Blue Hill at Stone Barns, it had a waiting list of 600 people every Saturday night. They did not need our marketing at all. They needed hospitality solutions. So how was I going to charge someone? You know, I just couldn't, you know, stuff the same thing. And so we did a couple things. One, we created a set of metrics to decide how important were these restaurants in driving overall marketplace dynamics. So a restaurant like Salina Door here in the city, it was going to bring in a fair amount of activity, almost like an affiliate in our channel. So we looked at a bunch of data because I wanted to remain intellectually honest, because the salesperson will come to you and say, all restaurants are important. This one's super hot. But I wanted to remain intellectually honest. So we created a restaurant power index, which actually was, it came from actually our head of product who had come out of LinkedIn, because they were selling products at LinkedIn. And Google would tell LinkedIn all the time, like, well, why should we pay you anything? Everybody comes to Google, you know, LinkedIn to look for jobs at Google. And then when they can't find the job at Google, they'll go look everywhere else. And so what we did was we created a system that we could be intellectually honest if we were going to give a discount. Yep. Like, we could very specifically value what this partner or restaurant was doing in terms of driving in other value inside the organization, and so that if I gave a discount, I was being intellectually honest about it. That was really a stopover in terms of a longer-term solution. I mean, again, in this case of the marketing solution, we didn't act or behave like a marketing partner. And so if you want a restaurant to spend money with you, we needed to give them agency and control with how they were actually choosing to spend money with us, as opposed to saying, yep, whether that diner shows up at 2 o'clock on a, you know, Tuesday when you're not busy, or 7 o'clock on a Friday when you are busy, they're valued the same. And what we needed to do is give the restaurant more power. And, you know, look, we had outsourced a pretty well-known pricing expert in the Bay Area, and they solved the wrong problem for us. They tried to put all of our customers in one tidy, neat little box and said, okay, you can do this. First of all, it was super complicated. I was like, if you can't describe something in an elevator ride, you're gone. You're done. but they didn't understand the difference in nature and really put the role in the restaurant's hand to say, hey, we're going to let you figure out how to spend the money on us. And so we ended up evolving our product to be able to do this. It was sort of, you know, kind of creating AdSense for restaurants, but in a much simpler way. But we gave the restaurant power and control, and what happened is they were thrilled to spend money with us because they could connect the ROI very specifically to what they were doing. And in that case, they knew that it was building their business, where before they didn't understand it, they didn't trust us, they didn't have the data associated with it. And I think it was an area of huge frustration and as evidenced by the low NPS that we had with those restaurants when I started.
I'm curious also, when you're running sales organizations of hundreds of people across the globe, and you've got all these market nuances, you've got all of these, you know, kind of different types of customer personas of the restaurants that you're working with, How do you aggregate all of that feedback? And this gets a little bit into organizational design, but how do you take all those field sales reps and like incorporate that into the products and tech that you develop?
It is hard. I will, you know, I still have Bob Iger in my ear from my days at Disney. He's like, if you don't go, it won't grow. You do have to go. You have to sit there. You have to meet the restaurant. You have to understand their problem, understand their challenge. But you also have to like have a good Pareto principle that you're approaching everything with. So for example, in Japan, yes, it's very hard to, you know, key in, you know, like someone's name while they're on the phone. Like, was I gonna build this like unique add-on feature for the Japanese market? Not now. Let's get to the 80% of the features that feel more universal than, you know, and I think that the exceptions to that rule are like if China, for example, happens to be a huge pathway for you, you might need to create product specificity. But usually I find that if you just serve the majority from the product requirement set, you're going to get most of the way yet there. And it's only when, you know, you in most markets actually don't warrant from a size perspective creating too much specificity on the product side. And so, you know, most of the time we didn't, but it was also, you know, to your point on organizationally, it was, you know, how do you connect to these markets? How do they feel like they're included? How do they feel like that we're thinking about them as part of the process? And in many ways you do just, you have to go.
Yes. I'm curious also how you think about org design, especially internationally. So as you were hiring all these folks in different regions, were you having those folks report up through regional heads? Were you having things dotted line back to HQ? And kind of like, how did your org structures evolve over time?
So I ended up pulling, you know, I think there's always this tension between federation and centralization. And, you know, I think you get different kinds of people who want different things. And in our case, it had been very federated. And you know, you lose a lot of efficiency there. So marketing had been federated. Well, did it really make sense for, you know, somebody in Germany to be buying keywords when they didn't have the scale that they were going to get the right partner or efficiency associated with it? Probably not. And so I think we did a blend of trying to figure out, you know, what things benefited from scale and what things actually required, you know, the distribution. So we ended up pulling almost everything in such that the only thing that existed at the edges was sales function itself, you know, with you know, some centralized, you know, inside sales and some other things. And then we did allow them to do business development. And the reason we did that was most of the time the biz dev deals were not, unfortunately, going to bring a ton of money on their own. They were really a way to tell the restaurant, hey, you should come with us. So, like, let's get Qantas. So now I can sell an Australian restaurant because it sounds like there's, you know, a combination there. So making sure that we're able to, you know, kind of give the salesperson what they need to feel like they're going to be effective on the ground.
What types of things triggered a reorg for you at the company where you're like, oh, gosh, this isn't working. Like, we need to reevaluate. We need to revisit.
Well, almost everything was a reorg when I got there. And every time I'd pull up a stone, I was like, wow, there's a lot crawling up underneath that. But, you know, I think that, you know, having been in companies that, you know, I joined as few as, you know, less than 100 people to scaling those to over thousands of people, I do think, you know, one pattern I've observed is I call it this exponential scale of breakage, where, you know, at 50, 150, 500, 2,000, 10,000 people, the org breaks. And I think I look at it and say, okay, how do you lean into the breaks? By the way, it's a great thing if you're breaking because it means you're growing. The alternative is no growth and no breakage, and you essentially hibernated. None of your VCs want that. So you're going to break. And so, you know, how do you use those moments of breakage as organizational leverage? So, you know, organizations, like engineers, hate process. Like, so they're going to come in and be like, I'm going to give you a little process. And they're like, no. Like, they're going to reject every part of it. But then when you break and people feel the immediacy of the pain, that's when it's your time to say, hey, actually, if we thought about this, we could do something more efficient here and reframe how. And so I always told the, you know, anytime something bad happened or the breakage happened, lean into it, feel it, understand it, and then benefit from it. Because your organization is going to, it's a sign that something isn't working the way that it needs to. And that your job is to lean in and be proactive about it, not give excuses for it, but say, what is this break here trying to tell us? What's not working well? And let's go tackle it.
Let's talk a little bit about culture. So having spent time at Netflix, I'm obsessed with culture. I'm sure you guys have probably all read the Netflix culture deck. They actually continue to update it and iterate it, so constantly go back to refresh it.
I didn't know that. I've only read it that one time.
No.
It kind of came back, but I didn't know.
They're in a constant state of iterating on it. I think one of the takeaways that I had from my time at Netflix was that Netflix really tried to remove process, bureaucracy, politics. And the way that you do that is that you set great guidance and context from the top, you hire absolute A-plus talent, and then you mostly just like get out of their way. I'm kind of curious, like, what was the culture like when you came into OpenTable, and then how did you change and evolve it? Because I think you've got some interesting things there.
I think, I think every company, the culture is bigger than the CEO, it's bigger than the founder. I've almost analyzed them in an anthropological way, but the culture that I found upon entry at OpenTable was very fear-based. It was, oh my God, what if I do something and it doesn't work? Oh my God, like we just like don't screw it up. Because for many years it just worked. You kept on selling, you kept on going, like, and so the fear of being super innovative was actually embedded in the culture. And so counterintuitively, well, one of the things I learned as CEO, the hard way actually, which was what are your levers for changing or at least directing culture? And I thought, well, I'm gonna just, five of our 10 values, my head of HR would make fun of me. He's like, five of your 10 values are essentially move faster. And I was like, but they're not moving fast enough. What I realized was that actually the lever that I had as CEO was what I chose to reward and what I chose to not reward. Because essentially people come into your company, which is this strange society that has a set of rules, and they're trying to figure out, how do I survive here? What are the rules of the road? And none of them are written down, but they're spoken to and handed down almost like in lore. There's like an oral tradition of this time and so, whatever. And so what I had to counterintuitively do was make it unsafe not to take risk. And, at first that was, on the good side, it was people who are trying new things, taking risk, shining this incredible spotlight on them. But if you were staying still, that was not a safe place to be. And I think that message quickly resonated throughout the organization. Was it perfect? It was not. Did it, kind of flush through, every DNA strand? It did not. But over time, you could start seeing, the evolution. Because at the end of the day, I would say not too dissimilar to what Henry had said, which is, culture is how people make decisions when you're not in the room. When you're in the room, it's fine, it's easy. But as you scale, more and more meetings happen without you in it. When presented with that A-B decision, which way is the culture going to decide which way do you go? And I think the rules of the road, the reward versus lack of reward, or what and how people are ultimately going to decide which decision is the right one.
I also think it helps retain top talent. It's like when you actually have ownership and autonomy over decisions, like you feel empowered to make decisions, like A-plus talent, like, they just like flock to that type of, kind of power in an organization.
Well, I think that there is, and this goes back to some of the organizational design questions. Like, we had a dreadful matrix. For example, like on our consumer app, there was a team that was required to put all of the whatever, the innovation into the app. And so essentially what their job was like, I got to put 10 packages on the ship. If I get to 8, fine, 7, whatever. I don't even know what's in the package. And so re-architecting such that people could have ownership in a full stack way to say, like, I'm going to live, breathe, and drink in all that, so I'm going to know whether we're success or, there's a success or not. And I think giving people agency, yes, but also, there's sometimes our, organizational challenges, there's technological and architectural challenges that have been introduced [S2] Yep. [S1] That actually make that hard. And so some of these, Amazon famously with the, the service-oriented architecture is enabling all these teams to then plug in, but a lot of companies don't work like that. And so what do you do when you don't have that? And so a lot of times it's like artificially creating barriers so that they can be in a position to feel like, okay, we're gonna tackle this thing head on, and we're gonna feel like we've got ownership in the stack to be able to do it.
have to say, I love what Henry said earlier also around how they think about kind of exit packages and it being the same, whether you choose to leave or whether you're asked to leave. Curious, like any hiring, firing philosophies that you've picked up through
that
the
years?
That
was an interesting one. I had never actually, I mean, it's sort of like, I guess, Zappos paying people to leave. So not maybe similar to that. But, you know, I think, again, anytime you know it's not right, it's not right. And nobody, you know, I mean, it's now like a tired adage, but, you know, like nobody wished they waited too long to fire somebody kind of thing. Yep. But I think, you know, there's also only so much pain you can endure immediately. I mean, I chose to, like, when I first got in the role at OpenTable, I had to, you know, replace myself as CFO. I, you know, decided to move on our head of product. I didn't have, so I was basically at that point I was doing CFO, CPO, and CEO, and then it was clear that we needed to evolve our sales organization. I mean, like, so basically, you're like, there's only so many hats you can wear at once, and so you know, I always say, like, what's the fire closest to the house? Go focus there, but you know, I think to Henry's point, there's a way of doing it with humanity and grace. At the end of the day, you know, it's you know, I'm always looking at, you know, what are you good at doing? What does the company need you to do? And what do you like to do? And if those three things sit on top of each other, then we're in a good space. Oftentimes they come out of alignment. And it's something like the company needs you to do something that you don't even like to do. And so how do you sit there and have the conversation and say, look, this isn't even your wheel set. Like, you're actually really good in this 0 to 150 phase of a company. Let me help you go find that. And doing it, you know, and you know, when I was at Disney, I had to, actually I had to let go of hundreds of people at one point when the strategy changed around, you know, where we were going to drive profitability. And to this day, people I've fired are still, like, really good friends with me, because I think there's a way of doing it where it's like, I see you, and you drove value, and it may not be the right part of your journey to be here at this time, but what you did still mattered. And I think to his point around, like, if you left and you felt injured, it was because you didn't feel valued. It didn't feel like your time there was time well spent. People spend, you know, most of their waking lives at work. And so you have to feel like it was a valid part of your experience, and I'm going to validate that, and I'm going to actually get you to the place where you're in the best position you are to contribute and have impact, frankly, in this life.
Performance plans. Friend or foe?
One of the things I've learned in my, I'm now, you know, I've been in business for a while, is this idea that, like, you know, an apple will not become an orange, will not become a lime. Like, if you want that person, and so, you know, to be more specific, on my team, I had incredible blank sheet people. And then I had people who just got shit done. They were never the same people. Almost by definition, the blank sheet person can't finish the last 15%. And if I put them on a performance plan to finish the last 15%, they will fail 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple alternatives I have. I can either, like, lament it. I can put them on a PIP and get them. Or I can say, what is this person's genius? Maybe this genius is not applicable at this company anymore. But if they have a genius, how do I compliment them? Like, pair them with the person who's incredible at the last 15%. But you're not going to get somebody who's really good at one thing to all of a sudden become good at another thing. And I think it's your failure, frankly, as a management, a manager, to say all of a sudden, you know, I want this apple to become an orange. And so I guess I'm not hugely a fan of them. I understand why HR does them, but I don't think it's, and frankly, you should have been having this conversation all along. I think oftentimes too, when there's PIPs, it's a byproduct of lack of seasoning in your management ranks. And so oftentimes when a company has scaled quickly, one other good question to ask yourself is, how many of your managers are first-time managers? How many people are you asking them to manage? Like, do a health check on the managerial level of your company, because what you'll probably find is actually there's a lot of people here who don't effectively know how to manage people, don't know how to read those signals, aren't capable of doing that. And I think once you tune into that, you might be in a better position to not have the PIP.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, too, of having two tracks in a company where you can still move up and be an individual contributor and be rewarded with the same, you know, kind of power, compensation, title, et cetera. You don't have to manage a huge team because it's not everyone's skill set as well as the management track.
I think that works well in engineering. You know, I haven't seen the marketer IC track as effective for some time, but I do think that, yes, not everybody is cut out to lead and drive, and they don't want to, and that's not the best way that they can contribute.
Yeah. So I'm curious, what's next for you?
I have enjoyed sitting on Lightspeed's board of a firm. I'm really enjoying the fintech space. I will operate again. I've been working since the age of 10. I had a paper route. I was the sixth of seven kids when my parents were like, if you want to go to college, figure it out. So I had to pay for my own college. So I've had a hustle or a side hustle since I was 10. And so this year I was like, I'm going to, and I use your phrase all the time, Jana, and I don't always give you credit, but you know, it's like, it's rewirement, it's not retirement. I needed time to rewire, but I think I've got the energy and mojo and frankly, passion to go solve another hard problem.
And are you looking at taking on any other board roles at this point?
At this point, I'm going to pause. Although I always joke, Max is an incredible salesperson. He was like, just come along. You can do, you know. And but it's been incredible to learn fintech from Max. But I am not currently trying to add more board seats. I'm putting my heads down and looking at new operating gigs.
Got it. Any particular spaces that you're excited about?
Jana, you're like a reporter.
Inquiring minds want to know. What's
well,
next?
I will say, you know, I have deep affection for the SMB. I feel like there is, they are the gear that makes our, you know, countries, societies work. I mean, there's nothing more honorable than deciding I'm going to go hang a shingle. I'm going to go put this, you know, put my life, my family's life on the line. One of the things we said at Open Table all the time was they put dinner on their table by putting dinner on your table. And there's something so honorable about starting a business, starting a small business. So it might be in that angle. I'm kind of passionate about that space. And obviously, I'm a sucker for marketplaces, too. I'm a nerd about them. And I like how the network economics ultimately works.
Well, whoever gets you next is incredibly lucky. So I will close with this, though. So the topic of today is scale. And of all the different kind of things that we've talked about, what's like the number one thing that you think that these entrepreneurs and founders and CEOs can do to scale their company?
You know, we talked a little bit about cultures. That's a given. I'd say really pay attention to the anatomy of the team. You know, this was sort of referenced with the Atlassian thing, but, you know, A-plus talent not functioning well within team will drag the whole team structure down. Yep. How many of you analyze the effectiveness of the team? You know, I saw this a lot in gaming where, you know, people who could, you know, tell each other to piss off, get a beer, and get back to work in 8 minutes were the best teams because they could speak honestly. And so, you know, if you have high-functioning teams and if you have high-functioning leaders of those teams, you can go anywhere, really.
Awesome. Well, Krista, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about Krista, you can follow her on Twitter at CQuarles, at CQUARLES. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes or wherever you're listening to and rate and review it. You can also find us at tbtpodcast.com. Tomorrow Built Today is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. The theme music you heard today is by Mikhail Manvalin.